You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm David Wessel, Director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Carney to our virtual stage today. Extraordinary is an overused word, but Mark Carney's career qualifies for sure. In fact, if you look at his resume, you'd think he must be 96 years old. He was born in Fort Smith, Northwest Territory in Canada, which I mention only because a Google search turned up that its official motto is perseverance. He has an undergrad degree from Harvard, a PhD from Oxford, spent 13 years at Goldman Sachs, a decade in the Canadian government, including 5 years as the governor of the Central Bank of Canada during the global financial crisis. And then because that wasn't challenging enough, he became governor of the Bank of England from 2013 to 2020 during the whole Brexit mess. He's now an advisor to the British Prime Minister on climate finance, the UN Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance, Vice Chair of Brookfield Asset Management, mentioned as a future potential candidate for the Prime Ministership of Canada, and is only 56, and I'm not going to deal with his collegiate hockey career. Mark must have decided that he would write only one book in his life, so his new one, which is called Values, Building a Better World for All, is really several books in one. It's a history of money, a discussion of what markets can and can't do well, a primer on climate change and what to do about it, lessons on leadership, and then some. I'm probably one of the few people that read all 20 paragraphs of the G7 finance ministers' communique that came out over the weekend. I think Mark Carney's book has a background briefing on almost every one of those 20 chapters. So we're very happy to have you with us, Mark. And as people know, if you want to ask a question, you can type it into Slido, SLI.DO, hashtag Carney Values, and I'll try and get to some. But I thought we'd start with the very provocative and interesting title of your book, which is Values with a parenthesis around the S. And you talk about the tension between value, which is a market determined something or other, and values, which has to do with our moral being. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what were you trying to do by putting those two together? And what does that tell us about how we should run a society that is market driven, but not market controlled?
Right. Well, thank you, David. Thanks for having me. And thanks to Brookings for putting on this event, but really for all the great work that you do. I've been a huge consumer over the years and beneficiary and expect to over coming decades, I hope. David, yep, you and I read the G7 communique and maybe pull some of that out. I'm not sure anyone else did, but many people will be affected by what's in that communique. It's actually a more important communique and underlying decisions than before. And I'm sure we'll get to that. In terms of the, thank you for going straight to the title, because the parentheses is there because what I'm trying to get across in the book is that the causality between value and values goes both in both directions. So on the one hand, you have circumstance, which, and I'm obviously simplifying, but in the run-up to the financial crisis, some of the underlying values that support good market functioning, and this is a point that goes back to Adam Smith and I think most political philosophers and political economists, I should say. And in the end, most market participants would recognize that there's a role for regulation, but there's also a role for other institutions in the sense of Douglas North, which are customs and rules that support good market functioning. Well, we lost some of that. There were other mistakes in regulation elsewhere, but we lost some of that and the balance went out. And that was one of the contributory factors to the financial crisis. The next relationship between value and values is I just simplify and I'll ascribe to Michael Sandel, which is the marketization of aspects of society. So there are the effort to bring in certain elements of activity, whether it's charitable activity, volunteering, I can go on, but in effect, bringing them into the price system. And in that process, depending on the activity, in the process, there can be a corrosion of the value, corrosion of the incentive. So it actually ends up being counterproductive. That's not the core element of the book. It's an observation, which I needed for completeness. The third aspect is when value can deliver societal values. In other words, the market delivering societal values. And really what I'm getting at here is the example, I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about it, in terms of climate change. So as we move out of a trade-off mentality, which, you know, it's almost bred in the bone in me as a policymaker, as an economist, but to a hierarchy of certain, there are certain objectives, societal objectives, which become a focal point. And I argue that we are moving to that position now with sustainability. Then the market, properly informed with the right tools, will be the driver of delivering those solutions. So value delivering societal value. So yes, the book, there's a lot in the book, but it's trying to capture those elements and using the experience of the crises that I lived through, and others, of course, on this this webinar will have been active participants as well over the course of the last 10, 15 years.
But do you think if you had to look at the needle, are we too far towards the market or too far toward the moral imperatives at the moment, or is that not so simple?
Well, I think we were, and I lived through this as a policymaker, we were definitely too far to the market in the run-up to the crisis, the global financial crisis. And, you know, it was an era of, I don't think it's an overstatement to say market fundamentalism. I was infected, you know, with the cognitive capture, if you will, of that as well, where the answer to market failures was generally to create new markets. You know, market failures were missing markets. And again, since this is Brookings, I can use this shorthand to say it was an Aero Debra world, right? We had incomplete markets. And so the answer is missing markets. Now, of course, if the students of Aero Debra know that there's a lot of fundamental assumptions that go underneath that perfect competition, you know, commodity goods, et cetera, which most of which don't exist in those circumstances. You also had, and this is a real balance for policymakers, you had a belief that, as Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa would say, that the policymaker had nothing to tell the market, only to listen and learn and divine the lessons of the market. And so there was the, you know, clean, not lean approach in central banking. There were other light touch approaches in regulation, other aspects that were there, and very little, lots of reassurance of the market must have it right, or something like subprime was unlikely to, you know, wasn't going to happen, as opposed to, and much less of, well, what happens if it does happen, and what would we wish we had done in that event? So I think in that case, we definitely had the pendulum wrong. I think in the case of something like sustainability, I'm not sure that we, you know, the issues with climate change are the product of tragedy of the commons, of course. That's a market failure, can be fixed through an externality, through a carbon price, other factors. So that's something we're more comfortable with. I tried to argue over the years that there's also a tragedy of the horizon, in that we are discounting the future quite heavily. And by the time it's a clear and present danger in terms of physical impacts of climate risk, it's too late to take into account. So the question is, how do we change that? But in the end, that's a question of, it's a small p political question, which is, does society value sustainability? And until we get to that moment, the market isn't fully going to be in service of that value, nor are regulators. And, you know, we may get into this more, but I'll just take the opportunity to say this, which is that what we very clearly did 6 years ago in setting up with Mike Bloomberg, the TCFD as part of a G20 process, but really a private sector process. What information?
Task Force on Climate Disclosure.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Task Force on Climate Related Financial Disclosure, which was a standard to for companies to, and it is not a standard, a recommendation, voluntary recommendations for companies to disclose not just their current carbon footprint, but what are the risks going forward and what might they do about it. That, when it came into being, was, look, this is just to provide information for the market, to make a market in transition, because some people thought it was an issue. Some people didn't think it was an issue. So you can have a market. some who thought it was an issue thought governments would ultimately act, and some who thought it was an issue thought governments wouldn't act in the end, and therefore this wouldn't ultimately end up in the price, or it wouldn't end up in the price in a reasonable horizon. Now that shifts as you roll forward to today, not to the same degree in every country, but in many, many countries, and there's a lot of momentum around this, the countries actually say, no, we are going to move to net zero. It's a legislated objective. We are having a carbon price. I'm sitting here in Canada, legislated carbon price going to $170 by 2030. Even though it's Canadian dollars, it's a lot of money. So that's focusing the mind, and that brings forward the future. So we see that shift. That's a very long way of answering your question in terms of the values, but those values in the end are determined by society, and you need that process. But if you do, and I'll finish here, David, and this is where, you know, I spend a lot of time with people who are very focused on the environment, not surprisingly, given my roles, they tend to far too heavily discount the market and underestimate the power of the market if it is focused on finding solutions to an issue, even one as big as climate change.
Great. I want to get back to climate change, but I want to talk about the nature of money first, and particularly your thoughts on the fixation that a lot of people have with cryptocurrencies and what the potential and the risks are. And I noted that the G7 says that they seem to be warming up to the idea of central bank digital currency, say it can be a liquid safe settlement asset and so forth. And they seem to be really down on any rush to global stablecoins like Facebook's, formerly known as Libra, until we get a better regulatory thing. So put this moment of cryptocurrency in perspective for us, and where do you think it's going, and what should we do to make sure it has more positive than negative aspects?
So I thought that was particularly eye-catching as well in the communique, all aspects of that. And so let's take a step back. So why? I mean, we're in a time of proto competing currencies. The Facebook's effort, which is now called Diem, I guess, instead of Libra, which is a stable coin. So for those who, I mean, most people will know, but it's the idea is it's a crypto instrument which is backed one to one by the underlying asset. So if it's a US dollar DM, it's backed one-to-one with, you know, ideally, by the way, and this is a key point, ideally not just treasuries, but liabilities, you know, safe, risk-free liabilities in US dollars that matches the maturity of money, which is instantaneous, right? Kind of hard to get. I can think of one place that provides that called the Federal Reserve, but I can't think of anywhere else. So, you know, by definition, you've got some mismatch. And just while I'm on that topic, history shows Bank of Amsterdam being an example in the book, where the temptation to run a bigger and bigger mismatch over time for a private sector stablecoin, which in the end was basically what the Bank of Amsterdam was, is just too great. And ultimately, how credible is that commitment? So
what era is this Bank of Amsterdam?
It's the 1600s. It ultimately they come a stuck because they end up not just running a mismatch, but they lend to the Dutch East India Company. And people realize that the Bank of Amsterdam bills have risk associated when they previously were back one-to-one with the gold and silver that had been deposited there. So that's a real, there's lots of concerns with stable coins, but that's one of them, which is that in the end, they'll get a new CFO, a new treasurer, ultimately they'll stretch, there's a money for nothing type approach. And in the end, why wouldn't you just have, as the central bank, if you're going to have a stable coin, why wouldn't you have your own stable coin, which would be a central bank digital currency that is tokenized? Now there's other forms, which is account based, which I suspect is where this will go. Okay. That's the context of what's happening, though, is we have currency competition basically running up. So a series of crypto assets of varying degrees and varying purposes, varying degrees of being money. Most of them are not money. They're not used as means of payment. But some of the most interesting ones are those that are solving specific gaps in the payment system. So some of them are for wholesale finance, US dollar coin, JP Morgan coin, or for wholesale finance and getting efficiencies in there. And they're doing it in a way that, you know, actually serves a role. So I think there's legitimate questions whether, or legitimate possibilities, shall I say, that those will continue to play a role. Some are trying to play that role on cross-border payments and lower the cross-border payments fees. I think in the end, the central banks can get to a position where they solve that issue, but we'll see. Some, and it has to be said, and we've seen the examples in recent weeks, like Bitcoin, yeah, there's a gap in the payment system. It's called illicit finance. It's called ransomware. It's called terror. I mean, you know, it literally is. That's one of the gaps. Well, that's not a gap we necessarily want to close. And so anyway, so you get the point. So there's this... And these are questions of the values underlying money. We need something that's resilient. We need something that's transparent. And it also needs, key point, an adjustment mechanism so that fairly shares burdens. So, for example, the gold standard, I talk about the gold standard in the book, and you're a student of it, I know. It was ultimately felled by, you know, too much weight of adjustment on labor in the end. You put all the weight, you know, that's always been one of the risks in the euro as well. So where do I think it's headed? I think we will have central bank digital currencies. I think they're more likely to be account-based than token-based. I think that they will, hopefully, that those central bank digital currencies, there will be some efficiencies in terms of cross-border, the linkages, so the cost of cross-border payments will come down. Most people won't see the CBDC because they'll see the wallet from a bank or a tech company or a fintech company. That'll be their interaction. We'll still have a lot of inside money, in other words, endogenous money creation by those private financial institutions, which will be indistinguishable from the CBDC. But there probably will be in parallel some private monies or so-called native currencies for specific applications that are legitimate gaps in the payment system that are used by a subset of users, and the interoperability will have to be established there.
So an account-based central bank digital currency, but I won't have an account at the Fed. That's I'll have right. an account with the bank, and the bank will have essentially a digital account with the Fed.
Yeah, exactly. And just as it does today, but what will be interesting is it won't just be the banks that have those accounts. And by the way, I'm more confident that this is what will happen in the UK and other places. And maybe I'm not trying to speak for the Fed, but it could be the Instagram wallet. It could be a fintech company's wallet, so some other consumer facing, and they need to have that account up top as well so that the settlement is just across the accounts. There's no settlement risk. There's just across the accounts of the financial institutions at the, in this case, the Bank of England.
I see. And the advantage of that is largely efficiency and competition.
It's efficiency, it's competition. It is, as I understand it, and you know, I'm not the one doing the program, but it is also potentially programmable, i.e. programmable for smart contracts and other applications, which, you know, are potentially very attractive. So contingent contracts in effect, potentially very exciting and add efficiencies to the system, although they're still, you know, like much in this area, it's pretty nascent.
Hmm. And I think we'll be a currency-less society in a decade or two.
I don't think in a decade. I mean, just you think of the people you know, and maybe you were kind that I was. You were suggesting I was younger than I am. I mean, I am 56, but I know a lot of people who always will carry cash. So I always said when I was governor in the UK was we will, you know, continue to produce banknotes as long as people want them. And I think, you know, we've got a few decades where there'll be a residual.
Hmm. Okay. So let's turn to climate. And I think your basic argument is that if we're serious about resisting climate change, and you think we are increasingly serious about it, that there's a growing political consensus that, doing nothing or doing as little as we've done so far would be a huge mistake and a disservice to our children and grandchildren. And your basic argument, if I get it right, is you want to bring climate risks and resilience into the heart of financial decision making. And so tell me how that happens. How do you get companies and banks and insurance companies and consumers to fully internalize the costs of our behavior, which is contributing to fossil fuel, to greenhouse gases and so forth?
Yeah. So one of the key organizing principles for this is net zero. So what's happened with climate change is, and this has always been understood, or it's been understood for a long time, that we can't stabilize the temperature, whether it's at the Paris stretch objective of 1.5 degrees or it's at 3 degrees. We can't stabilize it until we get to net zero greenhouse gas emissions. And I'll shorthand that to carbon emissions.
Can you just define what net zero means?
Yeah. So net zero means that the emissions, any emissions that exist because of not just human activity, human or, agriculture or other activity, that those are removed from the atmosphere. So there is some net process. And the two obvious net processes are, one is forests while they're growing. So new forests while they're growing. So you remove net once you get to the height, you're net awash, and carbon capture and storage of some form. Those are the two most obvious ways. So you've got to get absolute emissions way down in order to be able to net out whatever you're still doing. And the point is that the temperature is, the physics of it is, it's a function of the stock of carbon in the atmosphere, greenhouse gases. So you have an organizing principle now of net zero. We're at about 130 countries and counting who have said net zero is our objective. Glasgow, the COP meeting, the UN meeting on climate this November, is a net zero COP. So we're trying to continue to increase that. US has joined this. China's made its commitment. Try and get a few other emerging economies in there. But it's 70% plus of global emissions are organized net zero. So then that rolls down to, if you're a company or a financial institution, the question is, and you operate in these jurisdictions, what's your plan for net zero? Now, you can have a plan, which is, well, my plan is, there's three options in that. One is, I don't have a plan because I don't think this government policy is credible or that this will actually happen for whatever reason. That's an option. Maybe some issues with stakeholders and employees, and you may be surprised, but that's an option. The second is, I don't think I can get to net zero, or I'm in a sunset industry in a world that's moving to net zero, and I'm going to run off my business. Most people don't choose that option, but you could legitimately, and I'm going to defease these, or I'm going to defease certain activities over 15, 20 years. And the third option, which most major companies seem to be picking, is I'm committing to net zero by 2050. I'm putting in place a plan. By 2030, I'll be at this point, and here's what I do. So now you're moving into a financial system, which is getting that information. TCFD is related to this. It's not the same as a net zero plan, but it's related to it. So in the financial system, you have this information. You're judging companies in terms of whether they're likely, do they have a plan? Are they likely to succeed with their plan? Are they going to be competitive in a world that's moving to net zero with, if not a rising price on carbon, tighter and tighter environmental regulation, more and more competition from low carbon technologies in their area? And then that is a decision point on value. That is an influence on company value. And not just in the extremes of renewables versus, coal and heavy oil, but all the way down through, moving into the core of the system. And that's what's happening now. And for those who may not follow it closely, President Biden's summit in April, there was an announcement of a new alliance, which is the core of the financial system, the major banks, insurers, pension funds, et cetera, from around the world, 160 of them, $70 trillion of assets, which even, for Brookings in the US is a huge amount of money, committing to net zero. So committing to have these plans for their own assets and manage their balance sheets in that way. Now, last point, if I may, and there's lots of other ways to, build this out, scenarios, stress tests, other things to make this tangible. But what is critical in building the system is that the incentives are there to finance the transition. So in other words, the incentives are there so that I lend to or invest in a company who may have high emissions today, whose emissions might even go up for the next few years, but by lending, investing, giving them capital for a period, those emissions are going to come down over time. And avoid, what we want to avoid is a very, on the surface, satisfying sort of binary approach, which is there's green assets and there's brown assets. And, you know, get rid of all the brown and just go to the green. Well, that's not a transition, that sort of wholesale divestment. And that won't get us to where we need to go because we need the steel companies to make some big investments. We need the automakers. We need the, you know, and on to deploy the capital so that the core of the system gets its emissions down.
Let me pick up on that because when I noted on Twitter that I was going to be talking to you, I got some people, I think you've probably heard from them yourself, that suggest that a company like Brookfield, where you're involved in doing a lot of investing in renewable energy, is also investing in fossil infrastructure, pipelines and stuff. So what is the role of the big institutional investor? You're suggesting that not investing in fossil is a mistake because it doesn't give them the resources to make the transition, or what's the argument?
Well, yeah, it's entirely situation specific. So Brookfield is one of those, that's part of the 70 trillion. We bring 600 billion to the 70 trillion. So we got them to the 70 trillion level because we're a member of something called the Net Zero Asset Managers Alliance. It's a large alternative asset manager. So what are we doing is we have, we map our carbon footprint. We're developing decarbonization plans across all our assets. We have a specific strategy, which I'm very much participating in, which is to help accelerate the transition for companies of, you know, a specific transition fund strategy. But we're also addressing the overall, footprint of our, as I say, that 600 billion of assets. But to be clear about Brookfield, I mean, it's one of the biggest renewable power generators in the world. It's over 20 gigawatts of power on four continents. It's got another 23 gigawatts in production. And, you know, that's London and Paris or Chicago and New York in terms of scale of generation. It's a huge amount. And then here's the key thing. And so I'll say about Brookfield, but it's a point is generalizable, is so when we own pipeline infrastructure, for example, the energy, you know, so the judgment is about what's the terminal value of those pipelines. So how long is there likely to be natural gas going through these pipelines? Is there option value for that asset to be converted to hydrogen or some sort of hydrogen blend, which extends its life, gives another opportunity? And that is a fundamental part of the value judgment. Now, I would say, last thing, that sort of thinking hasn't been mainstream in the capital markets, but it is moving from periphery to mainstream quite quickly, which is going to enhance the value of certain infrastructure assets because they have option value or because they're going to be longer lived, because it's in jurisdictions where either it's the lowest carbon solution for a period of time or one of the lowest carbon solutions for a period of time, and or it can be extended for other reasons. But that's part of thinking about the transition. So it's very so just to finish, the sort of simplistic thing, which is what we're trying to avoid for the system as a whole, is to say, you own a pipeline, you're bad. That's hypocritical. No, it's not. It's an energy transition. We have to make judgments, Brookfield does. Others will make different judgments about what works where. We might, we could be wrong about some of them. The transition could happen sooner, but we're grown up. We can, we get more right than wrong, and we'll deal with it accordingly.
So you're speaking to us today from Ottawa. As you mentioned earlier, Canada has moved to put a price on carbon. The U.S., of course, hasn't, and it doesn't seem to be imminent. Isn't that going to create some issues, and it's going to be difficult for Canadians to feel like, well, this is great. We're doing our part, and the U.S. is getting a free ride, and there's going to be carbon leakage and so forth.
Well, yeah. So the issue of carbon leakage is a is a growing one in trade policy, and as your question suggests, David, in politics, this judgment of it's often expressed in terms of, it could be Canada and the U.S., it could be Canada and the U.S. and China, right, in terms of the time path of emissions. I think that maybe I'll answer it in terms of how we think the trade policy might go around this issue. The first is that it's a smaller group of tradable products for which this is a big issue. So where mm-hmm. carbon is a big component of the value add, but there's some pretty politically emotive ones. Steel would be a classic example. The second thing is that what is being openly talked about, these carbon border adjustment mechanisms. The president's mentioned it. The Europeans are launching an initiative on it. The Canadians talk about it. One of the challenges to be WTO compliant with this is the easiest way to do it is based on a carbon price. Because you can look, I have this price, you have a price that's half mine, clearly, but when the US doesn't have a carbon price, then you move into a world of shadow carbon pricing, which is harder to map and easier. So, is the equivalent of my emission standard, worth X on the price of on the price of carbon? You get the point. So there's that world. The other route is around product standards. So having carbon components to the product standard for steel. Steel has to be of a certain quality. And that, my personal view, cutting it short, is that I think that, kind of over the next several years, it's more likely to land on the product standard side, not least because the U.S. Doesn't have a carbon price and, it doesn't seem likely to have one in the foreseeable future, despite all the, economic benefits of going down that route.
I'd have to say that this steel was made in a way that had a limited amount of carbon emissions.
Yeah, and you can, and the thing is that actually, it won't just be an assertion. The ability to measure this is part of these disclosure standards and others is the ability to map that, not just in the steel making process, but obviously from the power that's provided and the carbon in the delivered to the delivered steel, to the ports here.
What about China and India? This is often raised. Yeah. We can't fix this problem without them. They say, oh, great, you used up all this carbon capacity to industrialize. Now you want to restrain our growth. The Chinese talk a good game, but they're still building coal plants. India's got all sorts of issues. When you talk to them, how do you explain to them? Well, how do you read them? Are they serious about this? And how do they play in this world?
The easier to answer the second, incredibly important, decisive, even. There's a few, at COP, it's a UN meeting. There are 195 countries. They're all equal, but some are more equal than others. And obviously the US, the EU, China, Canada, clearly, are more equal than others. How do I read them? I would say that the Chinese are, so a couple of things about the Chinese. One is that they have pretty explicitly taken a view that being low carbon and having low carbon industries or being leaders in industries that enable low carbon is a fundamental driver of competitiveness, medium-term competitiveness. So there's a big economic motivation to their push to towards net zero. So that's first. And that point, I think, has not been lost on other major economic powers in that, so this is reinforcing the market in some respects, the competitive juices around the industries of the future. The second thing is that the Chinese on coal have just started to shift their stance. So Xi said at the Biden summit that they will peak on coal in 2025 and manage, begin to manage down. I mean, it's all very fuzzy, to be clear, but it's it's that impression on coal in the latter half of this decade, which is the key. And the look, the objective is you know, coal down in advanced economies by 2030 and 2040 in emerging economies. So, you know, the extent to which the global carbon budget can work, there is an element of growth and then tailing off in those. I further think, I mean, the Chinese are, as you know, big in solar, biggest in solar, biggest in electric vehicles, biggest in a series of other things. We collectively have a strategic issue around the rare earths that are essential for a number of these climate applications. And so the development of alternatives is critical, including in Canada. Canada is part of the solution for that, but it's an expensive part of the solution. So we need to, the collective, you know, G7, we need to think that through. But on balance, I think China is a force in this. And, you know, obviously the largest emitter, but also one who will increasingly be central to the solutions. I think India's more straightforward. I mean, it's a complicated place to govern. It's a, you know, it's a federal structure, but the commitment at the top is quite clear. Whether it's formalized into a net zero commitment remains to be seen. But the scale of ambition, particularly on the power side, is enormous. It's one of the most attractive growth opportunities, and I think that they. I'm pretty upbeat on India in terms of what actually will happen on the ground, not least in that the economics of a number of the solutions have shifted. But, you know, David, make no mistake, we've left this issue, the collective, we have left it very late. And so the scale of what needs to be done is enormous. And if we, you know, you can pick Canada, what's Canada, you know, I mean, we've got huge changes that have to happen. Here and that's true for virtually every country.
There's a question sometimes about the role of central banks in this issue.
Yeah.
You've pointed out that in the UK, the Bank of England has pretty broad supervisory responsibilities, including for insurance companies, which of course the Federal Reserve doesn't have. Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank has suggested that maybe they should be greening their portfolio of bond purchases when they do things like quantitative easing. That seems to give the people at the Federal Reserve the shivers. So how would you describe, I think the role of the central bank as a financial supervisor in this area is pretty straightforward. If the institutions are taking risks that they don't fully understand, it's the role of the supervisors to point that out. So that's the easy part. But when you get to things like green bond portfolios, do you think that's a step too far, or do you think this is such an important issue that we have to use every tool we have?
Well, I think, yeah. So I think you've summarized it well. And I'll just, for those who don't follow it on a daily basis, I can understand why you might not, but the Bank of England received, my successors at the Bank of England received three letters a couple months ago, which said Monetary Policy Committee, Financial Policy Committee, which is the Macroprudential Committee, the so-called Financial Stability Committee, and the Prudential Supervisory Committee, take climate change into account what you do, Chancellor. And it's all consistent with the legal framework. So as a secondary or supplementary objective, you got to take it into account. And what the Bank of England is doing is now in last week, and I would recommend, you know, people are interested, if you just search on the website in the last 2 weeks, they've come out with a discussion paper, a consultation paper on how they may tilt, and that's their words, their bond purchase program to take climate change into account. And they own about 6% of the UK corporate bond market, but obviously it's a central bank and it could have, you know, could set a standard, in a de facto standard, depending on how they do things. But they've also received a letter that says, you know, this is the kind of things you should do, because this is, it's not just like the current government's policy in the UK, it's legislated. Net zero is legislated. There's annual, you know, requirements, et cetera. So it's so integral to policy that you too have to take it into account. Now, port over to the US, where it's the current government's policy. It's not legislated. There's not this mechanic of regular letters from the Treasury Secretary to the Fed Chair. The principle in general, and when I was a central banker, and the principle the Fed would be under as well, is one of market neutrality. When you go in the market, you try and, you know, sometimes deviate from this as in monetary policy, but you generally, you know, try and buy across the curve. So you're not disturbing, you know, still have price discovery, but you're getting the portfolio balance effect on quantitative easing. Or you buy or you lend collateral, you have a credit standard. But then once you meet that credit standard, you more or less can put that collateral in. So this is putting another overlay on top of it, which my personal view is you need that grounding in that the Bank of England has, that the ECB has, by dint of the Maastricht Treaty and their requirement for them to take into account the core policies. I forget the exact language, but it's pretty well grounded legally. And I can assure you that the place is stuffed full of lawyers who look through these things. And if they get it wrong, the German Constitutional Court will be looking at it, et cetera. So that's incorporated. My read, and there's more experts at the Brookings Institute than my expertise on the Fed. My read is that that doesn't exist for the Fed. So you're going to end up with different central banks doing different things. And they're both, you know, they're all right. They're all correct in what they're doing. It's a nature of the institution.
I see.
I do think, by the way, David, I do think that some of the commentary of some people around this is quite poorly informed when there's like, well, you know, the bank's reading in a bunch of the Bank of England or the ECB new responsibilities. Well, it's the exact opposite, actually. The Bank of England couldn't be clearer.
Assigned responsibilities.
Yeah.
Somebody from Canada wrote a question said, how do we operationalize your recommendations to embed deeper values in our economic decision making? You've made the point that when the society decides to do something, then the market is a good way or a way to make it happen. But the predicate is that the society has to decide that the values are important enough. And I think that the question is asking is, how do we make sure that policymakers in the society do that?
Yeah. So that is part of the reason why the book's so long. It actually goes through, if you go chapter 16, which goes to country policy, but it's in the leadership chapter, the purpose-driven company chapter, other aspects, these are examples of how you do it. So let me just give three quick ones. So it's not all about Sanger's objective, but one of the values that's important for market functioning is some sense of responsibility of senior managers who run financial institutions. Responsibility, not just for themselves, but for their institution and for the system. How do you embed that? And the book goes through this. You have, you know, it's alignment of compensation, you know, holding back bonuses, and when can those bonuses be clawed back, under what circumstances? The book goes through what we did in the UK on that front. It's something like the senior managers regime, where I'm explicitly responsible. I'm not responsible for everything that 10,000 people who work for me do, but I am responsible to make sure I train them, that they knew the rules, that they gave them the tools, that they had the support, and I had some monitoring things. And if I don't do that in the UK, I am on the hook for that. So that's how you embed responsibility. In terms of sustainability, part of the way we do it, apart from countries setting up objectives, climate stress testing, scenario analysis, those types of supervisory requirements we increasingly have in financial institutions, that gets you thinking as a senior manager there, as the board member, well, what does my portfolio look like if the country actually does what it says it wants to do, which is to, you know, get to net zero? And it's, you know, I might want to take that risk, but I need to be informed of that risk. And nobody knew the answer to that question a few years ago. People are discovering the answer to that question, and then they'll take their own decisions. And then around resilience, and I'll stop here, which is another one of the values in the book that's emphasized. And to be honest, I twin that with humility, another important value, which is something I said earlier, which is getting, and this is maybe a little more for public officials, but getting into the habit of planning for failure. Don't spend the whole time telling yourself the cyber attack won't get through. Think about, what do you do in the event that a large systemic bank is frozen for a period of time because of some successful cyber attack? how do you keep the system functioning? What is the backup? What do you do in that case? Countless other examples, but that's part of the role of building resilience in. And so some of its institution, these are examples basically of how you embed it. And it's not sitting around holding hands and just saying, okay, let's be better people and everything will come. I mean, the book is anything but that. And just to be clear, it's in the end, these are values about longer term economic prosperity. I'm an economist after all. I'm not writing something that's
Let me ask you, put your economist and veteran central banker hat on for a moment. I think there's some concern around the world, particularly here, that we had a very aggressive fiscal and monetary response to the pandemic, which worked out extraordinarily well. Yeah. I look at the forecast that people were making in March 2020 and where we are today, and I would chalk this up as a job well done by the fiscal and monetary authorities, and not only here. But now there's a growing angst that, okay, maybe we did a little too much and that we're at risk of pushing inflation up beyond our objectives. And I sort of wonder how you look at the world of inflation, particularly given what we see in fiscal and monetary policy here and in Europe.
Yeah, look, I think the prospect of let's strip out the last couple of last months and the very short term here, where it's been well telegraphed there'll be transitory factors that'll push things up, and then focus on the relevant horizon for policy. I think there are signs that inflation will be above target over the horizon from here. So if you were dropped into, to run the FOMC, David, next week, and you're looking forward, there are signs of in the labor market, signs in terms of supply shortages and other, that's a little more than a short term. There's also reasonable reason to expect sustained momentum, all subject to, it's not a black swan because it's right in front of our face. It's all subject to, the uncertainties of COVID variants and all that. But the prospect of inflation being above target for longer than the makeup of the past undershoot, I think the balance of risks is headed in that direction at this stage, I guess is the way I put it.
See, does that worry?
I started to lapse into a central bank speak there.
I noticed that.
Yes.
I'll put you down on, if you decide to add to the Federal Reserve to your central bank revenue, I'll put you on the hawker side of the spectrum. Mark, I think one of the things that struck me as I read the book is it's actually very comforting because you described some ways, and you did this earlier in our conversation, ways that we could embed values in our economic decision-making in ways that don't require us all to give up electricity or stop. We all ride bicycles. You describe how we can get from here to there. And you made the point earlier that it's going to be hard because we waited too long. But, when you look at the political system in the United States, when you look at the polarization here, when you look at what the UK has been through, when you look at the rise of populists in France and Germany, when you look at the Israeli democracy, I just wonder how you reconcile your relatively upbeat view that sound, well-meaning, thoughtful policymakers can get us to a better place with the political system that seems determined to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, it's a couple maybe suggestions on this specific issue, which is first, it does put a premium on measures. I'll shorthand them to green measures, but measures that have immediate payback in terms of jobs and economic growth. So high multiplier. I mean, it's an obvious point, but it really does bear repeating. And so, one of the simplest things to do, certainly in the UK, in the work there is, you go to those houses. I mean, all due respect, hope there's no one in the UK, but you would not, the room that you're in, the warmth would, well, you're in Washington, so it's about keeping the cold in, I guess, as opposed to warmed up, but things just leak out of the place. Like, they're incredibly, so the desire for home retrofits and all that, and the need for them, and actually it's a material contributor to their reductions. And of course, you employ a massive amount of people, that covers the whole country. It's has all those benefits. There's a series of industries, again, in the UK, on the renewable side, for example, the wind industry, which has also very high multipliers, particularly in some of the less advantaged, the Northeast, basically, less advantaged parts. So you do those things early that have tangible benefits that affect a lot of people, that create jobs, and you're like, well, this is what this is about, as opposed to everyone eating lentils. And as you say, riding around on the, same clapped out bicycle for the rest of their lives. In parallel, what you want to do is, and this is the hard bit. I agree, this hard bit with because of the political dynamics, you need enough of a consensus for this to be credible, which is you want to lay out a path for tougher regulation down the road. So the advantage in the UK of saying there's no new internal combustion engine cars sold there after 2030 is it's credible, and it's spurring investment in the UK in plants and other things. Now, one of the big decisions, I think, for the Biden administration is, what is the equivalent of that? It's not going to be 2030, but is it 2035? Is it 2040? Or is it not that explicit? Is it a fuel standard that de facto means that? I mean, it seems like GM and now Ford have already gotten the message anyway, so they may be pushing on an open door. But you're doing things farther out that then again spur investment today if it's credible and predictable. Again, I sound like a central banker, but it's something I worked on with Janet Yellen, actually, at the G30. It was a paper before she found something better to do than that. And we're going to have to rely on, and this is going to sound risky, but it is risky, that actually there is some tangible payoff to these measures. I think the last point, if I may, David, is, I think, would be interesting. Let's assume just for the purposes of this discussion, a change in the U.S. government, a change in administration, with skeptical end of the Republican Party, let's say, runs the two houses and the presidency. If facts on the ground are an economy that is increasingly geared to this and jobs geared to this, there may be more rhetoric than policy. There may be by that point, but that's what would be in my head as the, benevolent social planner, better have some payback by that point, so that the benefit of continuing. And last point, I just reemphasize something I said about China earlier, which is this is one of the competition points with China. I mean, without question. And it's, I would suggest it's going to be as big as digital, both from or tech, I should say, generally, both from a economic opportunity, but from a geostrategic influence perspective. So we'll see.
I guess I'm asking you
a different question.
Has your faith in democracy? You were governor of the Bank of England during the Brexit vote in the UK. You were very outspoken, and you talk about why in the book, about what would be the economic risks that Britain was running if it withdrew from the European Union. And as you say, you said we'd be ready, and you were. And you got some grief for speaking out. And yet, despite all the elites saying this is not a great idea, the British public voted to do it. And the British government, the current British government, has certainly upheld that part of the bargain. So I'm just wondering, Have you no doubts about the ability of our democracies to do this stuff?
Oh, no, I definitely do. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought my answers indicate. I was trying to give you a path that I start from the position of the premise of your questions, the last two questions, exactly right. There is this risk of this shift. It depends on the jurisdiction, though. I mean, for example, in Canada, look, it's 70%, I'll be more precise, of the votes in the last several elections were for parties that were as aggressive on climate or more aggressive on climate than the current government. So that's a pretty big consensus. Plus, things are being legislated as opposed to being policy. So you can change the way you get there. That what I just said for Canada holds even more so in the UK and Europe. But of course, if you're a politician, then mapping that into giving people what they really want, which is jobs and that progress, that's your job. The US is not in, you know, I mean, you know better than I, but it's not in that position. So the stop start is a risk. Australia has been in that position, stop start on climate. And so it does matter that, look, I guess the way I would put it to bring it back to what I try to write in the book is, you know, there is a value of dynamism in the book, which is, you know, sort of market returns and growth and prosperity. And so unless you're delivering that alongside sustainability, you're not going to get to where you want. And if I can just bring it again back to central banking, one of the things we're always cautioned at the Bank of England, cautioned is a polite way of putting it, is in our financial stability role, don't end up with the stability of the graveyard. Right. Don't pile capital so high in the banks and stack up liquidity so there's no lending. And that's something, and it was good that we had that pushback. It's good that we took it, took that seriously. So the analog to climate is, yeah, don't have the, I don't know, sustainability of the graveyard, if you will, or sustainability that truly, like, is sustainable in all sense, like it's flatlining growth, because that's not sustainable. That's not a sustainable political
equilibrium. Right. So, Mark, we have a few minutes left. I wonder if you could end on, if you had to draw a couple of conclusions from your chapter on leadership to people who are young or aspiring leaders, what would you tell them are the most important lessons that you've learned in your time in all these incredibly important roles?
Well, I've mentioned it earlier. One is this point on humility. So, and you know, it's the nature of the roles. Being a central banker, you kind of look at glass half empty a lot, including on Brexit. My job was to think about what could go wrong and prepare for it. So that aspect of humility. There's a more positive aspect of humility, which is, if you will, which is I certainly had a lot of good fortune to end up in the roles that I had, and to some extent, good fortune begot more good fortune. And so, don't take yourself that seriously, and remember your responsibility while you're there is to improve the place and leave it better. And then there is a basic point, which I think is increasingly understood, that, you know, as a leader, you're setting goals and you're catalyzing action. But you're not leading if no one's following. And part of the way to get people to follow is for them to be fully engaged in how to solve the issue. And so it's not just about having diverse voices at the table. It's an inclusive process so that they really are part of making decisions. They feel that they've been heard. And then even when the decision doesn't go their way, they understand and they get behind it. And that's a learned skill. Maybe it's inherent for some people. It's certainly something I learned over time, but it's really important to be able to do that. And it does take more time than top down, you know, leadership by fiat. But it's far more effective over time, and it's far more satisfying for everybody involved.
Interesting. Well, thank you. That's been a fascinating hour. I really appreciate your time. If we were meeting in person, I'd hold up your book, but I only have one in my Kindle, so I can't hold it up. But it's almost an encyclopedia. And I think that there are individual chapters that I will go back and read when these things are in the news, which makes it a very valuable resource. So again, thank you for your time, and look forward to your next act.
Yeah, thank you very much.